Ian?
Hello, and welcome to this pre-recorded millennial session for 2018. And I'm here with Awakened Saxon, which is a podcast. And we've got three people here, so I'll start with Finn. Hello, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi, I'm Finn. That's my nickname on the podcast. My actual channel name is The Awakened Saxon. I run the podcast Pride and Postidus. And of course, the name Postidus is a reference to the term prejudice. It's the antonym of prejudice. And prejudging, that's prejudice, where you make a judgment prior to evidence and reason. And of course, every right-wing belief, especially about race, is always boiled down to prejudice and how you must have formed your beliefs about, let's say, you know, blacks and their levels of intelligence on average. You must have based that just off of, you know, what your parents told you, no real experience, no data. In my personal experience, my personal life, I was absolutely an anti-racist until high school, where actually Stefan Molyneux, you know, listening to his channel, sort of, you know, revealed some of the actual evidence about race realism to me. And I sort of progressed from there. I'm not as libertarian as I used to be. I wouldn't say I'm a hardcore authoritarian. I still have a lot of libertarian leanings, although I will admit that I would favor some policies people would call authoritarian, specifically related to anti-immigration policies. If we have to have, you know, ICE deport people, that's fine. That's great. And also, I would favor some form of eugenics. I will say that's, you know, just to clarify, many people will conflate that with like just killing people, but it could be as simple as subsidizing good people, high quality people to reproduce, which is basically what Mensa is. It's a form of positive eugenics. So the podcast, the whole goal of the podcast is to be sort of similar to Jerry Taylor tier optics. Perhaps we're a little bit more offensive, but the goal is to wake white people up in a format that is at least close to digestible to most conservatives. And I understand that there's sort of an issue here where most conservatives are not willing to listen to an hour and a half podcast that's, you know, so-called far right. I don't market myself as far right, but I would probably be considered that based on, you know, the views of the podcast and my co-host. But the whole goal is basically to reveal to whites that we are under attack and that once we are replaced, there's really no recovery. We can recover from communism. We can recover from a bad economic system. We can recover from being exploited and all sorts of negative impacts, but we can't recover from being demographically displaced in our own homelands. So I'll let Mal speak next.
Okay, Mal.
I'm Mal, I'm a co-host with Finn and Darg on Pride and Postjudice. I got into this movement in a similar way to most. I was essentially red-pilled throughout my educational years, seeing as the upper classes are always filled with white and Asian students, and the lower ones always filled with masses of mystery meat, and frankly, groups that you simply can't differentiate between, aside from, you know, blatant skin color. And I'm sort of getting politically active because I find that the right wing itself has become almost held back by meek aspects. I've used this word before, meek aspects that have refused any sort of concession as to topics on race or identity or things like that. That's essentially my view of it. I do completely disagree with, you know, modern contemporary leftist thinkers and of course demographic shifts. And of course those are important, but I think we should also deal with the issue of infighting within our own groups. That's about it for me.
Okay. Darg, would you like to introduce yourself?
Absolutely. My name is Darg. I'm one of the co-hosts on Pride and Postjudice. And personally, I guess we're all sharing our red pill moments here. I guess I'll share mine. And mine was sort of emergent, sort of similar to Finn's, in that I came across a lot of right-wing content on YouTube, race realist content. I think the first person I saw was Jared Taylor. I saw some of his videos, and eventually I read his book, White Identity, which is fantastic. And by the way, anyone listening should buy that and give it a read. But anyway, I listened to a lot of this race realist content, and I saw the studies, and it's pretty irrefutable to my mind. The data is pretty stark. It's pretty clear. There are population differences. This is a result of evolution and divergent evolution. So that pretty well convinced me, but I wasn't yet ready to fully accept the sociological ramifications of this. And so when I reached university, one of the first arguments I had with a student was a black woman who implied to me that all white people are racist. And that kind of gave me a shock because I've never had an experience like that. I grew up in like a 99% white community. The blacks that were there were very well selected for. They were very smart. They were very hardworking. But when I got into, let's say, the real world, into the population centers, that changed dramatically. And at one point, I went to Chicago, and that was an eye-opener for me. And those of you who are listening, you might know that Chicago has one of the highest murder rates in the United States. Well, the second I got there, I heard gunshots, and I had the misfortune of getting off on the bus at the wrong bus stop, and there was just like, there were like five or six black men there fighting with each other. And I was, oh man, that was pretty awful. But like just the culmination of my life experiences that I've had in adulthood in combination with what I've learned both on the internet and from reading has given me a more racialized view of the world. And I think it's also important. This is why what I underscore on the podcast, I underscore that whites are under attack, and the data is clear and we can get into that later, but blacks by far have one of the highest rates of murder out of any of the races. And also, moreover, they commit black on white murders more than whites commit white on black murders. And it's like many fold. It's
10 times fold. So, we actually calculated that last episode where the per capita rate of whites murdering blacks is just about 0.12. And the per capita rate of blacks killing whites is about 1.2. So it's about a 10 times difference. If you want the exact number, you can watch episode 9 of Pride and Prejudice. And just to give Darg a bit of credit, he forgot to take credit for being the audio artiste of the podcast. He's a really good audio, and he actually makes his own music. But also, I forgot to specify, you know, we've gone over lots of topics in many episodes. It'll start off with a historical review of Baltimore or Haiti or South Africa or Rhodesia. Not every episode is a historical review, but lots of them are. And we sort of discuss how there seems to be this inevitable trend where as any area, any city, any civilization becomes majority black, it seems to inevitably decay and become a shithole, frankly, as, you know, a wise man once used the term. And so, you know, the podcast covers lots of topics, whether it's, you know, race realism or, you know, current events. We try to keep it, you know, timeless mostly. We will discuss current events, but I prefer podcasts that can be listened to in 2 years from now and not be irrelevant. You know, Fascination, for example, is a great podcast in terms of content. They do a really good job, but probably very few people are going to be listening to it in 10 years just because of how time sensitive the content is.
Oh yeah. Well, that's always a risk. So, I mean, what would you tell people is the range of topics that you discuss? I mean, apart from current affairs and race realism, what topics do you discuss on Pride and Prejudice?
Well, basically anything, any history of that's relevant to race is fair game. You know, whether it's regarding to, you know, colonization or colonialism or slavery, or even, you know, what did the first Europeans think about the Africans that they came into contact with? And, you know, when was, you know, for example, we discussed, you know, did the idea of scientific racism, was that invented to justify slavery? And no, it really wasn't. Scientific racism, if you want to call it that, the first scientific conception of race that was truly scientific, I would argue, was by a Frenchman. I forget the exact, I believe a new division of the earth was like 1683. And slavery had been, you know, in swing for well over, you know, two centuries by that point. So this, you know, that's just one example of one narrative.
European-run slavery, yes, but elsewhere in the world had been going on for thousands of years by then.
Right, of course, yeah. That's my ethnocentrism seeping in.
Yeah, but, you're Eurocentric.
Right, yeah. So, you know, that's just one example of the narrative that we addressed in the podcast. Last episode was focused on, you know, black on white crime, and also, you know, the recent migrant crisis in Europe, which is something that we actually pretty much touch on almost every episode. But we've, like I said, we just discussed Detroit, Baltimore, Haiti. There's really nothing that demonstrates that we are under attack that isn't fair game. But like I said, if it's timeless, we focus on that.
It might be interesting to talk about each of these things. You've mentioned Detroit, Baltimore, and Haiti, and the migrant crisis. And presumably you're talking about the European migrant crisis.
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about, could one of you cover Detroit for me?
Yeah, I think I'll do that since I'm the one who actually researched it.
Okay, you do
so
that.
Detroit, it was founded, of course, by the French, probably like Detroit, if you were going to pronounce it in French. And so it was one of the fastest growing cities. You know, of course, it's at the Great Lakes. It's not on the East Coast. It wasn't one of the first cities of the United States, still relatively early. And so actually, funnily enough, Baltimore, I'm not going to go over all of Baltimore's history, but I will address how it sort of interlinks with the Detroit and how actually the Great Lakes, the existence of shipping through the Mississippi and the Great Lakes, it all potentially was going to ruin Baltimore. And actually, I know that you want to have Darger Mal do Baltimore but in Haiti, but I'm actually the one that researched both of those. They might still remember, but we'll see what if not. But anyway, so with Detroit, of course, it was one of the fastest growing cities in the United States, one of the biggest industrial areas in the whole country and in the world. And it's skyrocketed into a very close, I think it was number four status at some point. And it's much lower now. It's not even in the top 10. And what happened was, around the 50s, in the 60s, it, crossed over from majority white to majority black. And then you had, the very famous, 1967 riots in Detroit. And I believe those sparked off. And, again, I would know this better in the podcast itself. That was actually our first episode. It's been a while. I haven't thought about it since. But basically it sparked off those riots by, I believe, the raid of an illegal bar where a veteran was arrested. And so you had, it was one of the largest riots, lots of people dead. And so really what happened is that you had this city that's perfectly situated to be great for industry. The Great Lakes, the ocean travel is the best for shipping industrial products. That's still how we get all of our goods from China, is over the ocean. So being, in the heartland of the United States, yet still having a fantastic route to the oceans is very valuable. And it was because of its, previously white demographics and because of its great location, it was able to expand and become a huge city. And then it just became, climbed rapidly.
What was it called? There was a sort of nickname for Detroit at its height. Was it Motor City or something like that?
That probably would be it, because it was, again, where all the, basically, if not in Detroit, it was in the suburbs next to Detroit, where all the manufacturers were situated. And actually Ford, technically, he actually moved out of Detroit relatively fast. He moved to a suburb of just outside of Detroit. I think it was south of it. And again, it's been eight episodes since, literally been 9 weeks since I've actually talked about Detroit. So I don't have all the history perfect off the top of my head like I would during the episode.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, it's fine. Okay, does someone else want to talk about Baltimore?
I don't remember much about Baltimore. We did talk about Rhodesia, Finn. If it's fine, if I could mention Rhodesia.
Yeah, sure. Talk about that. Yeah.
Well, I forgot which episode it was we mentioned Rhodesia. And a lot of people in our sort of circle understand the general history of Rhodesia. They might not understand the great betrayal that it was truly to the people of Rhodesia, on how initially Rhodesia was a colony for the United Kingdom. Though, of course, there were Boer settlements before that, and, of course, the Boer War. But that and aside, I'd rather not focus on, European wars between each other. But after the UK established itself there in the region, Rhodesia was essentially one of the largest producers of agriculture for the entirety of Africa. It got the nickname the breadbasket of Africa. I mean, during the Second World War, I believe, Rhodesia had given, probably in proportion to its population and resources, some of the most support for the United Kingdom and the Allies during the war. And despite all of this, simply because they didn't accept the majority rule of Africans there, despite the fact that there are many tribe conflicts there, so there isn't really even a coherent majority, because they didn't accept that, their own mother country, the UK and the UN, and all these sort of white nations that, frankly, betrayed Rhodesia had turned on them, and now we have Zimbabwe, which is, that's a story in and of itself.
Well, it's a complete disaster. It's a total farce.
Oh yeah, it's a sad fall from grace. It's almost like a tragic play, you could say, on how you have something that is a burgeoning society which has great capability for just human society as a whole. You don't even need to focus on any ethnocentric belief in that sort of situation if you want to, and then it just crumbles into nothing. It's literally just a desolate, another piece of land that is frankly never going to do anything for the next probably 100 years. China's technically now colonizing them.
So. Well, yeah, it depends what China do, doesn't it? But without China, it would be just the same for, ever.
It's so ridiculous how the white Western world treated Rhodesia and South Africa. And in fact, Rhodesia was so, its arm was bent so far, even South Africa had to basically abandon supporting Rhodesia just because the international pressure was so intense. But there's been, it's totally unprecedented the way that these white nations were treated by the rest of the white countries on Earth. There's been no other similar situation where, you know, every black country except for one was singled out by all the other blacks. Like, it just doesn't happen. And, you know, the only thing I could think of similar would be like, you know, Christians, you know, looting Constantinople, you know, like the Fourth Crusade or whatever. You know, that level of betrayal, like, nobody else has just sunk to that level. It's just sad that we do this to ourselves. No other group would be that stupid. And people talk about, you know, white supremacy. And I often joke that whites are inferior in perhaps the most important aspect, which is, you know, willing to choose your own side and protect your own people. And that side, in that respect, we are by far, you know, the worst group of all races, apparently. That's just the evidence speaks for itself.
And another point to add to what Finn is saying is that a lot of the countries that were going against Rhodesia at the time, and this is why I sort of focus on that point of infighting within the right wing, is that a lot of them were conservative, or they had conservative governments, and yet they still had put, they didn't have to put sanctions on Rhodesia. They didn't have to fall to the whims of any sort of left wingers.
Well, I mean, it was the start of the conservatives, wasn't it?
Pretty much.
I don't mean to trivialize it, but it clearly was the start of conservative government actually doing the work of the left.
Pretty much. You get this pseudo left versus true left sort of dichotomy within modern government. I mean, you could even see in like in your current country, you have Theresa May, however you want to say it, who is essentially
Treason May.
Yeah, she's a joke, you could say. The way she's betrayed Brexit, the way she's practically isolated the United States as being any sort of favorable negotiator in anything, just sort of, you know, Donald Trump is racist, whatever, falling to the whims of that. It's an absolute travesty.
It is, and it looks like she's about to betray us again with this UN Global Migration Pact that she's going to sign the day after tomorrow. It's just unbelievable, the scale of the treachery. The clip of her dancing in South Africa, and that was just like, I don't know, a week or 2 weeks after we'd heard all this stuff about South Africans, like white Boers being killed. And there was something going on at the time. It was all to do with the land seizures as well. And then she goes over there and does this stupid dance. I mean, you couldn't make it up. It was absolutely, it was surreal, but it was just abject, profound surrender to them.
Yeah, speaking of the South Africa, you know, I've still been working on a response video to this guy. There's like this mirrored video on Three Arrows' channel, the far right in South Africa. And I've made this graph where I, you know, have the 2014 National Assembly votes. And so you have ANC, which was at the time was led by Zuma, and you have EFF, which was led by Malema. And both of these people have been known to sing Kill the Boer in the past. And so the DA party, which is I forget the exact title, but it's Democratic Alliance. It's sort of like it's still a shitlib party. It's still a leftist party, but it's not like super anti-white. And so the super anti-white parties, which is ANC and EFF, both their leaders had sung Kill the Boer. And they won. So ANC won 11 million votes, 11.4 million. EFF, almost 1.2 million. And the DA had won 4 million. So an overwhelming majority of the people who got votes in that election, in the National Assembly in 2014 in South Africa, had been, basically they voted for Kill the Boer overwhelmingly. Imagine if there was a white country where, let's say, Trump had like saying like kill the N-word, and so did you know, some even more radical, let's say Richard Spencer was the farther right alternative, and those parties won like 60-70% of the vote of people elected to Congress. And then imagine in that situation that the media was reporting that blacks were not being targeted in that society. It would be totally incomprehensible. Nobody would believe that that blacks were safe in a society like that. But somehow whites are not being targeted in a society where all, you know, supposedly racism is power plus, you know, prejudice, right? Well, this is prejudice and this is power. So how is it not racism? This is the perfect example of anti-white racism.
Oh, absolutely. This is the thing. The racism equals prejudice plus power. But, well, in situations where whites don't have the power, where non-whites have the power, that just goes out the window. Because then they shift the goalposts again and say, well, it's not historical power. It's not structural violence of white supremacy or whatever. So it's not real power.
And the ironic thing is they celebrate whenever they get elected and they say, we're finally getting into power. And then they'll concede that that's not real power whenever you bring up their institutional representation.
Yeah.
And also I wonder, like, why isn't the left outraged about when blacks in South Africa or in Africa in general, when they have a populist platform where they appeal directly to the selfish interest of their own people, that's not derided as horrible racism or ethnocentrism. And I would agree that's ethnocentrism. I don't think it's evil per se. I understand that they're trying to act and they're appealing to the self-interest of their constituency. I get that. But of course, the left isn't concerned by that. They're only concerned when white people try to appeal to the interest of other whites.
This thing with the refugees. I mean, when there was an Australian government minister who said that white South Africans could come to Australia, they could get refuge there. And he was called a racist. But then if they're non-white refugees, then you're racist for not accepting them. So you're racist for accepting white refugees. But you're also racist if you don't accept non-white refugees. So basically, whatever is good for white people is racist.
Yeah, and they're not even, like as you just said, they're not even close to consistently anti-ethnocentrism. Ethnocentrism is a much bigger problem. If it is a problem, it's much more severe. It's not a problem, but it's much more pronounced outside of the West. Western countries are most
diverse. Everyone is more racist than white people.
Right. Yeah. China, they like killed some black guy for, you know, hitting on, well, it was more complicated than that, but essentially he, you know, tried to proposition a bunch of Asian women and he was basically beaten to death for it. So they literally have like, you know, the caricature of like the KKK in the 20s. And same thing in Africa, where they you have black Africans beating Indians because they're stealing their jobs, like Indians from India. And so racism is a much worse problem in South America, Central America, all across the world outside of white countries. And so if they were consistently anti-racist, they would spend the majority of their anti-racist activism, they would target that primarily at non-whites who are much more racist on the whole. But if you spend all your time attacking whites when they're the least racist, you're pretty much just a de facto anti-white racist.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. And on the topic of sort of that point is that white is sort of quote unquote conservatives in European countries will back down at any sort of point of sort of ethnic conflict. Wasn't it like Jacob Rees-Mogg? It was like the 50th anniversary of Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, where he said, "Oh, my father went against Enoch Powell. How noble of him! And I am still against what Enoch Powell said." It was so petty. It was like, why are you bringing this up when your own, the people you represent, white Britons, do not want you to back down away from this topic?
Absolutely. It was disgusting. And a lot of people were very disappointed there because they had thought that Jacob Rees-Mogg was a bit more based than the standard conservative. But then he said that. It was on the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of Powell's Rivers of Blood speech. And he tweeted a picture, a scan of a newspaper article that his father had written. I think it was titled "An Evil Speech." An evil speech.
Yeah, I believe it was titled that. Yeah,
and that was his father's position was that Powell had done something evil by giving this speech. And Rees-Mogg said that his father was right and he had been proven right or something like that. And he still stands by those words today. And then also another conservative, Daniel Hannan, at the same time did a similar thing. I think he said that multiculturalism had progressed peacefully, or it had been worked out, it had been implemented peacefully in Britain. So, you know, Powell, his warning was completely invalid, which is utterly, simply wrong. It's simply untrue. I would ask, would you say to the victims of Rotherham that multiculturalism had been implemented peacefully? It's just reprehensible. But the other point you made was, of course, that the supporters or fans of these conservative politicians do not want them to do this. And yet these politicians feel, either they feel pressured to say this stuff, or they genuinely believe these things. I think they probably do genuinely believe them, actually.
Well, if they're sociopaths, it's very easy for them to delude themselves into believing whatever the status quo is. I think that if you're going to be a good politician, a valuable trait is to be able to say with conviction whatever the public wants you to hear. And so I think that probably have a disproportionate amount of sociopaths and people, pathological liars, who convince themselves of the bullshit, even when it's destroying their own people.
But of course, it's not what the public want to hear. It's what their peers want to hear.
That's true.
We detailed the Rotherham, the rapings that occurred there in our last episode, actually. Darg, you covered that topic in detail. And it was absolutely disgusting on how there was literal institutional bias within pressuring the police force or within the police force itself to cover up the entire scandal. So they are receiving every institution available to them, both law enforcement, government, whatever you want, in their own benefit, yet they can still point their finger and claim that whites have this institutional control is just laughably absurd to me. I find it almost silly.
It was sick what was going on because the police were literally blaming the victims of this abuse. Like it was the victim's fault that the victim shouldn't be hanging around these guys. Well, hidden in the statement is actually implicitly the admission that these migrants who are coming over, who, by the way, are majority from Pakistan, these migrants who are coming over are sort of, they're violent. They do this raping. They're dangerous, the ones that are coming in. The police implicitly admitted this.
Well, I should qualify that and say there seems to be a greater tendency among them
to watch this
kind of behavior. That's just statistically observable. There's no denying that.
And it's the amount of the suffering that these victims experienced. Some of them were doused in gasoline, had firearms pointed at their heads, told that they were going to be burned alive if they didn't comply. And then when the parents learn of this abuse and the child finally escapes, they go to the police and the police just turn them away. Nothing happened. You didn't see anything. It's just despicable. And even the police give these mealy-mouthed apologies now that this has blown up on the internet and has been reported in places like the BBC. They give these mealy-mouthed apologies where they apologize that people were victims of something and that they didn't offer the services necessary. Well, it's not that you didn't provide enough services, the UK police. It's more so that you actively prevented your own officers from investigating this abuse and stopping it.
Yeah.
And so actually, I have a broad point about multiculturalism, which we actually mentioned last episode. It's one of my favorite points to make, and it sort of is reminded to me by you have Hillary Clinton saying, perhaps we should, tone down this mass influx of refugees to Europe because we can't handle it anymore. And I think that they're starting to realize that perhaps they've boiled the frog too quickly, which was not the intention. But, if the left was scientifically minded, if they're empirically minded, if they were pragmatic and utilitarian, which they often style themselves as being, they would not have advocated that multiculturalism be tried everywhere all at once without any prior experience. What they would want to do if they're scientifically minded, they would have said, let's turn one city, half sub-Saharan African. Let's see if it improves. Let's see if it declines. Well, I know it would decline. And of course, everyone would realize that. And so they wouldn't want to do a series of multicultural true experiments. They want to experiment with your entire nation. And before they want you to it'd be too late for you to realize that it didn't work.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a terrible idea.
And it's done in nations simultaneously so that the lesson can never be learned fast enough.
It's like, let's see if Russian roulette is a fun game and we're not going to test it out on a blank or anything. We're just going to start playing with a live bullet.
And then what's social funny, engineering, so sick.
What's funny is that it was simply based off the farcical, contact theory that was written in, wasn't the 60s by that Swedish whatever, I don't know what he was, but I know he wrote contact theory. And just off that basis, the United States has eliminated almost half of its white population, pretty much demographically over time, simply because off the basis of some farcical theory.
About contact theory, that was actually very recently proven. It already had small enough effect sizes in the studies, but recently there's been a meta-analysis. And inside the meta-analysis, they have uncovered evidence of publication bias for the studies that did show any effect from contact theory. So we can pretty safely say at this point that contact theory, which is the theory that if you have two conflicting groups of people, let's say white people and black people, if you place them next to each other, they'll work it out. The conflict will resolve itself if you just place them together.
If they have contact with each other.
Yeah, if they have contact with each other, with institutional support. But the studies that have been done on this show that there's very little, if any, positive effect.
Yeah, and of course, it's what happens is that, as Dark mentioned, what you see the largest effect sizes when you have the highest standard error, which basically means the smaller your sample size, the higher your standard error, the less valid your results. That's the only times that they've been able to find the results they want to publish. And so what happens is that they have these smaller samples, which are easier to study, and they have these higher standard errors. And so what happens is that they just don't publish the ones that look bad. If you have a higher standard error, we should see a sort of a greater cone where you have results both above and below that sort of standard error mark measure or whatever. And so It's a really bad sign when the highest effect sizes are observed for the highest standard error. And then if the effect sizes reverse or disappear when the standard error is very low, that means that you're probably like dead wrong, not just, you know, off the mark a little bit.
And relating to that point, and both the point about the spread of multiculturalism, essentially studying it, quote unquote studying it, you know, whatever they want to claim, over every country, I sort of equate it, and I've mentioned this in I believe our last episode as well. It's almost like Trotskyite Marxism, where they believe if one nation follows the doctrine of Marxism, then other capitalistic countries, which will have the bourgeoisie or whatever that have fled to them, will simply oppress them and prevent any sort of actual Marxism from arising. So by that notion, they have to have a global communism because it can't just be in one location. So these, and this also relates to the fact of why they want to bring diversity into Europe, because they don't want any white flight. They want to end that. They just simply want it all blanket covered. No more escape routes.
Yes, exactly. There's you're nowhere right that you can white flight to. So therefore, well, you're screwed.
I just wanted to add that, like, this isn't even in our words. The EU said that they need global solutions for global problems. And guess what that global problem is? It's mass immigration. They said this in regard to the UN compact.
Yeah, I can't remember the terminology. Mao, you want?
Oh, no, I was gonna add to that and how the EU is... Funnily enough, you know, you tend to see these left-wing papers or journalistic sites claim, you know, Orban is anti-democratic or any sort of right-wing push or party is anti-democratic, yet the EU is the most anti-democratic thing in existence. It is entirely federalistic. At the same time, it's also pretty centralized, and it wants to centralize itself even more. Again, in the 1990s, it was literally just the – or 1980s, actually, was the EEC, right? And then – now it's got its own flag. It's got its own military. It's got an anthem. I mean, Nigel Farage has said
it's not got a military yet. It's not got a military yet.
They're working on it.
I can't remember when it became the EU. It's had at least three different names in its like in the last 40 years. There was the Common Market. Then I think it was the European Economic Community, the EEC, and then it was the EU. But sorry, Finn.
Oh, I was going to add that the way they got power to become as big as they are was the most scummiest thing ever. How essentially didn't they blackmailed the UK. Once the UK's economy, which, you know, post World War II was not necessarily in the best state, and, you know, once the EEC or whatever free market short-term benefits happened, they essentially said, we're going to take away these, you know, no taxes with imports and free market deals if you don't sign on to these extra powers that you have to grant to us. So Margaret Thatcher was pretty much forced to have to sign on to them. And now they're just as big as they are, because once you give them a little bit power, they're just going to get more.
Yeah, yeah, it just goes on and on. And they even have the expression ever closer union. Which, you know, it's, and then there's the clip recently of that awful guy, what's his name? Guy Verhofstadt, saying that.
Yeah, Verhofstadt,
saying that he wants even more. I mean, he is a complete fanatic. He's completely. There doesn't seem to be any nuance in his thinking at all. The solution for him is always ever more power, going to, more sovereignty, going to Brussels. He's completely one-eyed about it. Finn.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting how the history of the EU is almost similar to the history of the United States in terms of centralization of power. And so people have, like, you know, let's say, you know, FTN, I was aware of this beforehand. They had like a deep dive about the history of the Constitution and how it was sort of a coup d'etat against the Articles of Confederation. You know, they're supposed to revise the Articles of Confederation. They come together and they basically completely replace the government with a much more centralized version, which, again, was still probably a lot more libertarian than what we have today. And so, you know, it's very similar in the sense that, you know, the EU started out as a very loose confederation and sovereignty was preserved for every individual state. And in the United States is very similar, where, you know, it was almost every state was capitalized, right? It was the capital S state of, let's say, Connecticut, right? And so, like, let's say, for example, the Civil War, like prior to the 14th Amendment, the federal government was the only people, the only institution restricted by the Bill of Rights. So states had a lot of autonomy. They could ban free speech. They could ban guns because the Bill of Rights didn't apply to them. It applied to the federal government because people weren't really concerned about their own states oppressing them. They were worried about a centralized power oppressing them. And so it's sort of similar how, you know, you go from a system where there's like basically almost total autonomy, but they still work together. And there's still sort of a centralized body which, with some power, but it's pretty weak. And it's the same progression. It just seems that it happened over, you know, a much shorter period of time for the EU.
On the topic of Verhofstadt, I believe he was a former Maoist, if I'm not wrong. A lot of these people in the EU, or especially any left-wing party in European countries, especially former Soviet bloc ones, like, you know, if East Germany or whatever, Bulgaria, a lot of them have all these communist ideals that they still perpetuate, and they still believe in some sort of unified globe. So they probably think that European identity itself is blocking that in some ways.
Yeah. And not just the identity of each individual country, but the European identity of Europe as a totality. Even that is a block ultimately. So, I mean, they'll want other, once the whole of Europe is covered, they'll want other countries to be brought into the union as well, with free movement of people, of course. But they, I mean, that, but even without that, they're still allowing free movement of people in. So, but that brings us to the refugee crisis. I would like to ask you, as three Americans, how did the so-called migrant crisis in September 2015, were you aware of that at the time? And how did it seem to you?
I'll go first, I guess. Yeah. So, I was definitely aware of it. I think primarily because of Molyneux, because, you know, as I said, he's sort of the one that, you know, put me on the track to race realism. And, you know, I was really, you know, thought it was a terrible idea. And what pissed me off the most is the fact that the Europeans didn't vote for these wars in the Middle East, and it wasn't in their interest, and they didn't benefit from it. It was, you know, stupid Americans were told that they could get cheaper gas, but they didn't really. When gas became cheaper, that was basically because of a breakdown of the OPEC as a cartel to a certain degree. It wasn't because of, you know, our success in the Middle East. And so, I mean, we're fighting to, like, you know, protect poppy fields and, you know, I don't know, keep building these governments which don't work and get replaced by ISIS. So what was the worst part about it to me was that we were lied into these wars. We didn't vote for them. They caused a catastrophe. And instead of resettling people in their own regions with their own language and religion and their own culture, this was used as a justification. Well, therefore, Europeans are guilty. And so, therefore, we must bring these people all in. And again, we've been over this in the podcast, but this concept of collective guilt is only levied against whites, never against non-whites. You know, why isn't Turkey constantly berated for not paying the survivors of the Armenian Genocide reparations? And I actually mentioned this in the podcast again. Why is the Holocaust so much greater in the memory of Europeans or people in general than the Armenian Genocide? Shouldn't the genocide, which hasn't even been acknowledged by the perpetrators, shouldn't that be greater in our memory? Why is it the one that hasn't received any attention? Like, it's completely inverse in terms of priorities. The Holocaust survivors have received billions and billions of dollars of reparations, for better or worse, and for the Armenian Genocide survivors have received none. Again, Turkey hasn't acknowledged it at all. Turkey, you know, has built minarets around, you know, Hagia Sophia. They've, you know, basically taken one of the most holy sites of, you know, Christendom, and defiled it with their shitty symbols. And they've repeatedly basically spat on Europeans and threatened to release migrants into, you know, the EU if they don't receive billions of dollars. Like, why is this a greater threat, or not a greater threat to us than, I don't know, like Russia or Hungary? You know, so it's like we hear more bad press about Hungary than Turkey, except maybe if Turkey, I don't know, kills some, you know, liberal who goes over to, I don't know, do whatever.
All right. Dark, what about you and the migrant crisis?
Yeah, around 2015, I was definitely aware of it, partly because of Molyneux and also because I was paying attention to a lot of alternative media sources around that time in general. But at the time, I was a pretty staunch, like, anarchist libertarian. So my relationship with borders was a bit tenuous. But even then, I recognized if there is a government, that government fundamentally has a responsibility to the people that pay its taxes. And not all people are entitled to access to that country. And it was blowing my mind that so many people would defend such an inversion of sovereignty, that somehow the world is entitled to a kind of sovereignty they've not earned, that they haven't earned by being part of that nation's history, of the shared cultural history and so forth of the nation. And fundamentally, what does the world contribute to the United States, like in terms of tax money, in terms of like altruism and so forth? I mean, just this idea that people should flood into the border was absurd. And of course, at the time, I was concerned primarily with the beliefs inherent within Islam. So like Sharia law, which is a complete contravention of feminist belief, by the way, that women should be respected and honored and treated well and treated equally with men. Well, Sharia law is obviously in an inverse of that. And so that was something that also very much upset me in 2015. And it was only a few years later that I would take this at a more racial angle. And at the time, I was beginning to learn about the race realist stuff. You know, if you import a bunch of people into your country who on average have IQs at about like 80 or 70, is that going to fare well economically? Are these people going to be as productive as people from, say, Sweden or Norway?
Yeah, of course, of course. Mao, do you want to talk about the migrant crisis?
Yeah. For me, by 2015, I was practically already red-pilled, as we would say. I was browsing Poll before then. I was browsing all the, you know, the websites that we know of. And essentially, I viewed it with a lot of anger that they used that picture of, you know, the child on the beach as essentially just emotional tear-jerking to an extent.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very crass. It was very crass. Oh, yeah. And of course, the thing is, that, and other people have made this point, quite a lot at this stage, that photo was just plastered everywhere, all over the media. And yet the pictures of child victims of Islamist terror attacks, those photos are just hidden. You see them on alternative media. You don't see them on the mainstream media at all. I mean, it's sickening. It's just, it's reprehensible.
I would even get into arguments with family members, you know, the more liberal family members that I had that would, you know, sympathize with it and say, oh, look, it's just a child. And I would try and show them the truth that, frankly, the people that are going to be moving to these countries, the people that are going to take the risk, or even quote unquote risk, whatever you want to say, I don't even want to give people any sort of, these people who are essentially invaders, any noble of a cause. They're essentially just there for money, and they're all grown men, and they're just there to get benefits. You could blatantly see videos of people going through Croatia, and there was that one video of the dude saying, there's not many good benefits here, so I'm going to Germany. And frankly, it was just disgusting to me. It angered me, even if I wasn't entrenched in race realism at the time, and I wasn't necessarily the biggest libertarian. I could understand that, you know, people pay into these social institutions that they're a part of, and they're also a part of it culturally, and now, you know, further I know, racially as well. And all of a sudden you have these people with no intention of building towards that coming in and just sort of reaping the benefits of something that they haven't even put into.
Well, this is the thing about a nation being far more than money. You know, each of these nations is something that has grown up over centuries, in some cases, well, I mean, it's got history that goes back thousands of years. And, well, the result of that, in the case of European countries, especially Western European countries, is a loss of prosperity and stability and civilization and money and a welfare system. But the welfare system is an expression of all of that prosperity, all of that civilization, and the altruism and the ethnocentric feeling of the population, that they want to look after each other. And then for foreigners to just be allowed to come in and pilfer that, just pillage that, this thing that is the result of centuries, thousands of years of development, and then to choose it as well, to judge this one against that one and say, no, I want that one instead, that I'll benefit, like welfare shopping. It's unbelievable.
I mean, it's sacrilegious. Me a point I made earlier, which is that allowing these people to come in is a violation of a basic principle of fairness. You know, if you have a house and you've built, let's say you, I don't know, let's medieval Europe, if you build your own house and it has rooms for extra people, somebody doesn't just get a move in there and enjoy the fruits of your labor, that infrastructure that you built for your own children. And in the same way, Europeans have invested in their own societies for centuries and millennia, you know, whether it's Italy, France, Germany, Spain, whatever, these societies that were made great by people for their own children. Their plan was never, I'm going to make Europe great so that it can be really convenient for the Somalis that are going to move here and take it over in 2,000 years. That was never the goal. Those people, you know, people in, let's say, 1900 would have been much, much less motivated to, you know, produce and work their asses off to make Europe a great place if they knew it would be inherited by people that looked nothing like them, didn't share their values, couldn't even speak their language properly, and wouldn't even grant their nation a basic amount of loyalty or abide by its laws when they got there. It's totally absurd and it's totally unfair. Why would you work to build something just so somebody else could inherit it on the basis of, well, they're entitled to it because they're what they eat and they breathe, therefore they should be entitled to a portion of your livelihood for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just that this isn't what our ancestors intended, and this isn't what they had in mind when they were toiling for millennia. It's not just that. It's that if you had told them this is what would result, then they would have stopped toiling. I mean, they wouldn't have cared. They would have thought, right, this is just doomed. So there's no point in me putting in any work at all.
Yeah, especially if you told the Christians about how Muslims would be allowed in. And this is a point, like, the reason I brought up the Battle of the Alamo in one episode is because I'm so pissed off that, you know, Texas is being, you know, overrun by Mexicans who have done nothing to earn the right to live there, right? You know, they want to basically take it over, not by right by conquest, but just by right by birth. And it's the same in Europe, where I'm so pissed off. We have, you know, the Siege of Vienna, or, you know, the Battle of Tours, and, you know, Charles Martel. We had seven centuries of the Spanish trying to reconquer their homelands from Muslim invaders, and we're just going to give that up over the course of a few generations because of my feelings, because of
the word racism.
Yes, because of a few pictures of a few dead children, regardless of how many white children die as a result of terrorism.
Yeah, indeed. Mike,
going back to a further point on how the left likes to paint itself as almost efficient or you know, empathetic, and they know how to use monetary policy to benefit, you know, the poor and the whatever buzzword they like to use. I believe a good initial red pill for people that I was talking to, debating with at the time, was how I believe it was Douglas Murray even mentioned that it costs more to bring a refugee to Europe and give them benefits than essentially just give, you know, charitable donations to organizations that could help them there.
I think the factor was 12. I think it was 12 times as expensive to bring them to Europe as it is to help them in their own homelands, but I'm not sure.
That's exactly the figure that Molyneux cited when I was still listening to him. So right. I think it's right.
Yeah, it's astonishing. So if you really did want to help people and as many people as possible, you would demand that they didn't come to Europe. You'd demand that they stay wherever they are in the Middle East or North Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa, and that we went over there and helped them and you know, sorted things out in their countries. That is what you would do if you actually really wanted to help them and in as effective a way as possible. That's what you would advocate.
And of course, you avert the risks of, you know, diversity plus proximity, where if you bring these people into one country, we always hear about how Africa is unstable because those dumb Europeans, they grouped too many tribes into one nation. Well, sort of implicit in that statement is that putting these diverse groups into one polity is a bad idea because there's a struggle for control of the whole nation.
Yeah, so that implies that multiculturalism is a bad idea, but it also implies that bringing them all into Europe is a bad idea. And indeed, we see that. We see different Muslim groups warring with each other on the streets of European cities now.
And right, and so you wouldn't have the risk of, you know, creating civil wars in Europe where you have Muslims or Christians or Muslims and atheists who are European vying for control of a state, and let's say it's quite possible within the next one or two generations, if not probable. And so that's a risk that we totally averted if you just simply resettle them, where, as you said, it's much more efficient to do so. Their worldview doesn't really seem that pragmatic or utilitarian or scientifically minded if you really just think about it. It's really, you know, it's either motivated by an anti-white bias or appealing to the prevailing anti-white bias because you want to be a good person, so that's why you do it, or because you just hate white people and that's why you advocate for those policies.
And another point to add to that on the whole, like, picture of the child is, was it not his death the result of the fact that Europe was so willing to accept people? If they were ardently, you know, saying, listen, I don't care who you are, if you come to our shore, we will not take you in, that there won't be the problem of smuggling. It was the fact that his father was so selfish that, well, no, his father was a smuggler, actually, but yeah, selfish nonetheless.
Paid smugglers, at least.
Paid smugglers, either way, selfish, to risk taking that journey that ultimately resulted in him and his child dying. Whereas if Europe simply said, no, I don't care who you are, what's going on, we're not taking you in, that I don't even think they would try and risk taking that journey.
How ridiculous is it?
I just want to correct. I don't think the father died. If I recall correctly, he survived, but the son.
No, he didn't. He survived, I believe.
Yeah.
How ridiculous is it? Like, this concept, like, just the image of this in your mind is so ridiculous. Like, these migrants, they won't even cross the Mediterranean of their own, you know, volition. They'll go like a few miles or 20 miles into the ocean and sink their own ship and call an NGO. Like, they don't even have the motivation or the determination to get all the way to Europe on their own. They have to, you know, piggyback on us for three quarters of the way of the trip. Like, it's just, you know, if they're not even hardworking enough to get in here on their own, they have to, you know, basically steal a, you know.
Well, that brings us to the terrifying fact of, you know, the NGOs who are facilitating this. I mean, Lauren Southern has been covering this with the Borderless documentary that she's doing, and it's actually terrifying. You know, there are people who actively want as many of these migrants in to get into Europe as possible, and are prepared to, you know, they'll tell them to lie. Doesn't matter, but the truth doesn't matter. They just want them in here in as huge numbers as possible.
They even have like lawyers in the United States that are part of organizations. When that caravan was going to the United States, the lawyers would, I believe, they would consult people, telling them to claim that they were. What was the phrase? They were asylum seekers or whatever. Whatever word will get you the ultimate free pass of
in fear
free
for my
stuff,
life,
essentially.
But that's the code word. It's like, in fear for my life. That's the code word.
Oh, okay. So they would be coaching them essentially to be actors to garner some pity or legal basis as to why they should get free stuff and residence in the United States. And
maybe
these organizations are multinational and funded by people who ultimately are not a part of the democratic process, yet they can, not directly, but indirectly affect entire nations simply off the whim of their money and their rather shallow idealistic thought in that all of us will get along together.
Yeah, and speaking of migrants and refugees in the U.S., like Honduras is an example, like one of the highest murder rate countries in the world. Why do we want these people here? You know, if you're so, you know, motivated to do something with your lives, why don't you march on your own corrupt governments that apparently are not to your satisfaction? Apparently, all their effort is just dedicated towards getting to the United States and then getting free education and healthcare as they, you know, basically make you wait 10 times as long in the ER.
Yeah, indeed. Well, that brings us to the U.S. situation. And so what would you all say about this recent caravan thing?
You can go first, Mal.
Well, I was going to say it disgusts me how there are people who are essentially pretty much claiming that they're just here for free things, being so, you know, so much viewed as poor and helpless, and they need our help by people who are essentially ideologues and will go on and on about how we need to be open and accepting. And of course, they'll be emotionally manipulative with another photo of some woman and her two children and tear gas, which Finn, of course, you're probably going to mention that tear gas is standard procedure with dealing with like riots and things like that.
Oh yeah, it actually
so
occurred.
The fact,
Obama, yeah.
The fact that we can't even use that against people who are actually invaders, I don't care whatever sort of emotional connotation that is, that they are invaders, that we can't even use that against them, and we can't even enforce our own borders, is absolutely disgusting. And I do applaud the fact that Donald Trump put soldiers on our border. Though I found it funny that neoconservatives, some of them were essentially claiming, well, that you're misusing the military. And it's like, what do you mean? Would you rather have them in the Middle East causing more essentially problems for us to get into?
Yes, they would.
Yeah. But also one of the most telling things about this event, which has been spread a lot on Twitter, was that I believe CNN, if not that, a CBS reporter who was, you know, he was corresponding with his, you know, liberal host or whatever. And they asked him, so tell us about these, you know, asylum seekers. And he said, well, actually, most of these are men. And a lot of them told us that they're not here for asylum. They're here for economic opportunities. So they even admitted that they're here entirely in contradiction to the goal of asylum, which is not an economic relief program. And, you know, the idea of asylum as an economic relief program is totally absurd. And one of the best videos on immigration ever, which is that immigration gumballs video, they pointed out there's way too many people in poverty in the world for us to just take them in and bring them up to a first world lifestyle with them being, you know, incompetent and not even literate in their own language most of the time. You know, and if they were competent, why don't they just stay in their home countries and fix them? So yeah, I mean, it's been a pretty telling situation. And also that famous tear gas photo, some, you know, very observant people have noticed that there's actually a lot of photo ops in the background. You see a lot of people who are like running towards a camera. Like if you look in the background, it's very odd how there's all these photo ops being set up, which exactly is probably with the famous, you know, woman carrying her children in a bizarre fashion with the ugly t-shirt and her belly hanging out of her shirt. You know, why would you want this person here? It does not look like, you know, a good addition to our society in any way. You know, what does she know about, you know, can she name even one state and its capital? What about, you know, does she know any of the Bill of Rights? What does she know about U.S. history? How many words of English does she know? Is she literate in English? I'm going to bet no. What asylum is she? She's fleeing asylum for what? Because her own people are incompetent and they can't build a society that functions well? I mean, that's not really a good reason for me to deal with your problems.
You can go ahead, Darg.
Yeah, I was going to say that the caravan itself is not as emergent as the media likes to proclaim that it is. Because often these caravans are being aided by groups like Israel Aid, who is, they have trucks. You can see their images of these big flatbed trucks that these migrants these caravaneers are riding on with like the Star of David on the side. These are Israel Aid trucks. There are multinational NGOs that are aiding this caravan. And you can see this around the globe. This happens in Europe with the European migrant crisis. And you can also see other examples of supposedly grassroots movements that have actually been funded from the top up or the top down. Like if you look at the Mujahideen in the Middle East during the 1980s, that was very much so funded by the United States. They were armed by the U.S. and the modern conflict in the Middle East is an extension of that. And so I think it's a good idea to view almost any supposedly grassroots movement as having some kind of top-down originator, and I think that's very much the case in the caravan situation.
Yeah, one of the best signs of a grassroots movement is that it actually fails because it has no top-down support.
And by the way, to bring back to the point of the gumball video, which was what I was going to mention, wasn't it like a Sargon or something? Or some skeptics claim that they'll simply respond with "I don't care" if another country is essentially seeping deeper and deeper into poverty. And you are benefiting from their intellectual capability leaving their country and going to yours, they'll simply say, well, I don't care. I'll just let them suffer for that. Their own government should fix that, failing to realize that that's just a negative loop of just their own government never getting the people that are capable to fix the problem of brain drain. I just find it absurd that people will be so selfish as to claim that they simply do not care for any other, you know, sort of well-being of a nation, yet at the same time, fall back and claim that they're individualistic and only care about the well-being of everybody.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the end, caring about the welfare of everybody, I mean, you have to make a decision. I mean, I think that's going to be brought home to a lot of people, both in Europe and in America, over the next few years. If it isn't becoming clear already, you know, you have to put some people first. Finn, you wanted to say something to wrap it up with?
Yeah, so I think that this kind of neatly ties all of our episodes into a bow. We hear this narrative of white privilege and how, you know, non-whites only fail because of oppression and racism and white supremacy. So Baltimore was like one of the biggest grain market in the world, or one of the biggest at the time of its peak when it was still had a white majority. Haiti was produced like the majority of the coffee and sugar for Europe at some point prior to, guess what, black rule. The issue was not that there was blacks around. It seems just that black rule itself was the precipitating factor for its decline. And of course, it remained in debt until 1947, after, of course, France demanded debt be paid, after it, you know, it slaughtered all the white residents and basically burned down their whole investment in that country. And tens of thousands of French troops died of disease trying to bring it back to French control. And so Detroit was, again, like one of the number one industrial areas in the U.S. Rhodesia was the breadbasket of Africa. So you have these areas which were hugely successful under white rule. Sometimes they still had a white population when they're successful. Sometimes they had a black population, which was, you know, being guided by a sort of, you know, white minority. And I'm not advocating for a sort of new global white imperium or something like that. Point being is just that black rule just does not work. And yet it's always blamed on whites. These societies, these cities, these civilizations were most successful when whites were running them, or when whites comprised them. And yet, every single time when whites go away, they fail. So the narrative of white privilege, it doesn't really make sense that it's universal. You know, if this was just an environmentally caused thing, you know, let's say the Chinese were, or the Japanese were only intelligent because of, you know, I don't know, environmental circumstances, you'd expect that perhaps there would be many countries which receive Japanese immigrants. They would just eventually decline to a level that was, you have these let's say expats of Japanese people in America who were totally incompetent just because, I don't know, they didn't inherit the environmental advantages of Japan. But it seems generally that, higher IQ minorities like East Asians, they do really well even outside of their own societies. And it seems very, just without error, very consistently, with some little exception, like the Indians. Indians, there are a lot of high IQ Indians in America who do relatively well, even though India is a low IQ country. It's true that if you have a massive population, you can have a few high IQ individuals go to a foreign country and have a small high IQ population. But generally, when you have like any group of Africans of any significant size in any foreign country, they just commit a lot of crime. They're poor. They're impoverished. Somehow, they're always oppressed. Oppression seems to just follow blacks wherever they go. They can't escape it. Most likely, this would be a result of some sort of innate attribute. This whole environmentalist explanation of racial differences, it's portrayed as inoffensive or like it's the default position, but blaming whites for a truly incomprehensible amount of suffering, that's not an inoffensive claim. That's an empirical claim which deserves to be examined and carefully and openly and honestly. It shouldn't be that one side of the debate is silenced because it's inherently evil. Whoever is wrong about the nature of racial differences, they are committing harm, they are causing harm in doing so. And so the debate shouldn't be about who's evil, the debate should be about the facts, because whoever's wrong about the facts is the one causing harm. And so the whole animus of the left, the goal of the left has been to shut down debate because, well, they presume they're right, and therefore they're immune to any contradictory evidence, and therefore blaming all whites for a grotesque amount of suffering is just the default position because it's the only permissible position in society.
Yeah, indeed. Well, okay, let's leave it at that then. So I guess people can, I'll give you the links to the Awaken Saxon YouTube channel and the Pride and Postages podcast. So thank you, Darg.
Thank you, Woz. It's good. Good talking.
Okay, and thank you, Mao.
No problem. Glad to be on.
Okay, and Finn, thank you as well.
Thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Oh, that's fine. You're welcome. All right, I hope everyone enjoyed that, and I'll see you in the next episode.